Good morning. 10:15 having arrived, I'm going to call this meeting of the Tax Committee to order for Wednesday, March 26th. First item on our agenda is approval of the minutes. Vice Chair Joy, have you had a chance to check out the minutes? Would you like to move them?
I did. So moved.
All right. Vice Chair Joy has moved the minutes for March 25th, 2025. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
That was a premature gavel rap. You'll have to excuse me. Is anyone opposed to adoption of the minutes before we? Okay. Hearing none. The minutes are adopted. Motion carried. All right. So first up on our agenda today is House File 1479. Representative Vernig, welcome to the committee. I'm going to move that House File 1479 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill, and I'll turn it over to you to describe your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, and members of the committee. Before you is House File 1479, a bipartisan bill, thank you, Chair Davids, brought forth by a constituent of mine that makes an adjustment to what is commonly referred to as the Minnesota Provider or Minnesota Care Tax Refund. Under current law, all medical provider, other health care, and prescription medication transactions in Minnesota are subject to the Minnesota Care Tax, a 1.8% tax on gross revenues. The revenue generated from this tax is critical as it funds Minnesota care and medical assistance programs, ensuring that low-income Minnesotans have access to essential health care services. Each March, pharmacies such as Sterling Specialty Pharmacies in Mendota Heights have an annual opportunity to recoup their legend drugs tax revenue from the state of Minnesota that they paid on transactions and medication sales outside of the state. The bill before you will simply change that refund from the state to a quarterly refund opportunity for pharmacies in Minnesota. I will briefly walk through how this tax or transaction works on prescription medications sold in Minnesota. The Minnesota Care Tax, which includes Legend Drugs Tax, is authorized under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 295. Specifically, Section 295.52 imposes a 1.8% tax on the gross revenues of various healthcare providers, hospitals, surgical centers, and on legend drugs sold or distributed in Minnesota. This includes a tax on what are known as legend drugs, or what we commonly consider as outpatient prescription medications. Think about it just like a sales tax on any product that you buy. The pharmacy buys the medication from the drug wholesaler, gets a bill of sale for the purchase of a medication. The wholesaler itemizes the Minnesota Care Tax at 1.8% on the bill of sale. The wholesaler collects the tax from the pharmacy and transfers and pays the 1.8% to the state, or the Department of Revenue in this case. The state keeps that 1.8% revenue tax, the money, for up to a year. And then each March 15th, there's an annual opportunity for the pharmacy to be refunded the 1.8% tax revenue on any transactions for dispensed medications outside of the state. House File 1479 would change the pharmacy's refund opportunity to quarterly as opposed to annually. You're probably thinking, why am I authoring this legislation? I haven't come before taxes before. But a constituent business, Sterling Specialty Pharmacy, which is owned by A-Strip Companies, an independent family-owned pharmacy, came to me with their cash flow tax impact situation. We worked with the Department of Revenue, Commissioner Marquardt, and his team to find a reasonable solution. This change does not affect any tax revenues for the state, and the Department of Revenue has officially indicated there would be no cost to make this reasonable change. For pharmacies like Sterling Specialty Pharmacy, this delay creates cash flow challenges. Sterling, which dispenses over 98% of its medications to patients outside of Minnesota, must wait a full year to recoup these funds. This often results in the need to take out loans to cover operating costs. By shifting to a quarterly refund system, it would help alleviate these financial burdens without impacting state tax revenues. I want to acknowledge the work of Commissioner Marquardt and the Department of Revenue, who have reviewed this proposal and determined that there would be no cost to implementing this change. Their help was invaluable in this work, so thank you. To further illustrate the impact of this change, I have my testifier, Randy Schindelar, CFO of A-Strip Companies, to testify.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schindelar. Please just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chairs Gomez and Davids and members of the House Tax Committee. My name is Randy Schindelar, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer of A-Strip Companies and Sterling Specialty Pharmacy. A-Strip Companies has been in business over 72 years and has become a staple in rural Minnesota under the Sterling brand and now operates 13 retail pharmacies, 4 long-term care pharmacies, and a specialty pharmacy in Mendota Heights. Over 400 Minnesotans are employed by A-Strip Companies today, and the company is now run by second and third generation family members. 8 years ago, we opened Sterling Farm Specialty Pharmacy. The drugs dispensed out of this pharmacy are sent directly to patients in all 50 states out of our facility in Mendota Heights. Somewhat unique to Sterling Specialty Pharmacy is close to 98% of our medications purchased are then sent directly to patients outside of Minnesota. This is significant because of the state of Minnesota places a 1.8% MinCare Legend drug tax on every medication purchased, even though 98% of the medications sold by our pharmacy are for patients outside of Minnesota. The way the MinCare Legend drug tax works is drug wholesalers that sell prescription drugs to Sterling Specialty charge the tax on 100% of the purchases and remit those taxes to the Minnesota Department of Revenue, even though only 1-2% of the company's purchases will be used to serve Minnesotans. The amounts withheld create a significant cash flow burden on the company until the tax can be trued up upon annual filing, and 99% of the amounts withheld are refunded to the company once per year. As demonstrated in the handout, this amounted to $1.51 million in taxes withheld in 2024, even though the company only had $42,000 in net tax obligations. The $1.47 million difference was recently refunded by the state through the annual MinCare tax filing. Since a refund can only be requested annually, it has put a significant burden on the company's cash flow. In 2024, the company attained an external credit facility, a loan, to mitigate the impact. But obviously, this increases our operating expenses. We set out this year, working with Representative Vernig, to seek a reasonable solution that maintains the spirit and substance of the existing law, but provides relief to companies like ours that have large amounts withheld that are not a true net tax obligation. We worked with Commissioner Marquardt's office to see if we could change the annual refund to a quarterly refund opportunity. This change will go a long way in reducing the cash burden and the return of the vital resources to our business operations. The bill before you today, HF 1479, is that solution. As Representative Vernig mentioned, the change in the law included in the bill language should simply change the Department of Revenue's MinCare Legend tax drug refund from an annual opportunity to a quarterly opportunity. I want to thank Representative Vernig, the other co-authors on the bill, and the Department of Revenue for working with us. I hope you will support this needed and reasonable change. I'm happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Schindelar. Moving now to member discussion. Are there any questions for Representative Vernig or her testifier? Not seeing any. Representative Vernig, anything you want to share with us to close out?
Thank you, Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, and committee members. This bill is a common sense solution that supports independent, family-owned pharmacies across the state, ensuring that they have financial flexibility needed to continue serving patients effectively. I appreciate your support and have a great day.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Vernig and Mr. Schindelar. With that, I'll renew my vote motion that House File 1479 be laid over for possible inclusion. All right, so we're going to go to 1529, Representative Cha. I neglected to mention at the top that we, Ms. Hagler welcomed a healthy baby boy yesterday, and so we welcome him. Welcome to Planet Earth, baby Hagler. Hopefully we'll be able to meet them in the future. All right, so I'm going to move to lay over House File 1529. For possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill. This bill, we heard it last year, it was included in the House tax bill as we took it into conference, And it was part of House File 2744. Am I getting that right, Patrick? Yes, that we heard last week. But, you know, this is sort of a unique situation that Woodbury's facing, and so we just wanted to invite you to share what's going on, because it's also a very expensive project. Welcome to the committee. Representative Cha, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you to Co-Chair Gomez and Davids for this opportunity to expand on this bill in regards to the tax exemption for Woodbury in House File 1529. As many of you know, this bill is not only about tax exemption, but it is about providing the basic necessity of water access to residents of 90,000 residents in Woodbury. You know, this will help ensure that Woodbury, the city of Woodbury, would meet regulatory drinking water standards for its residents over 90,000. I want to thank this committee for hearing this bill last year and to continue to give me the opportunity to be here to advocate for my constituents. With that, I would like to turn this over to Mayor Burt from the City of Woodbury.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Ann Burt, Mayor of the City of Woodbury. And thank you, Chair Gomez and Chair Davids and all representatives for allowing the City of Woodbury to come before you today. I want to begin by thanking Representatives Cha and Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager for their support in assisting the City of Woodbury on this issue. I would also like to extend our gratitude to Chair Gomez on this committee for initially including this bill in the tax bill last year. Although it was ultimately removed, we appreciate the committee's support and recognition of the challenges we face in Woodbury regarding our water. The City of Woodbury has been focused on issues related to water for over a decade. Water conservation and protecting this precious natural resource has long been a top priority for the city. We have taken action to protect this resource by implementing several things. One, we have a tiered water rate structure where people pay more as they increase their use. We have a restrictive lawn watering policy. In fact, it's probably one of the most restrictive in the state. And in addition, irrigation efficiency incentive programs have saved more than 143 million gallons of water annually. So water quality remains one of our priorities. However, over time, water quality has emerged as a top issue in Woodbury due to the discovery of PFAS in our water system. The City of Woodbury has taken proactive steps to address this issue by building several temporary treatment systems that help to deliver the highest quality water possible to our residents and businesses. In the meantime, we're currently moving forward with constructing a long-term PFAS treatment solution through eventual completion of a permanent water treatment plant, a water tower, and all the corresponding pipeline that goes with it. While the 3M settlement funds will cover a good portion of the construction cost of these solutions, the city is still facing a significant gap of up to $35 million to complete these projects. The city is doing everything we can to reduce the burden placed on our residents by the situation brought on by an outside entity. Eliminating the sales tax on city-funded materials, supplies, and equipment used in the construction of our water treatment plant, the water tower, and pipelines would be a step in the right direction. Therefore, on behalf of the City of Woodbury, I humbly ask you to pass House File 1529, which provides a refundable exemption for these construction materials. We are aware that this type of request has been granted to many public facilities, and we would appreciate your support with this common sense tax policy to help the City of Woodbury and the residents reduce the cost of this much needed project. An infographic of the project is in your materials. And again, I thank you, Madam Chair, and members for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you very much, Mayor Burt. If you wouldn't mind sticking around, I think one of our members might have a question for you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gomez. Thank you, Representative Cha, for bringing this forward, and Mayor Burt for bringing this forward and talking to us today. As you know, I live in the area, southeast, and I think this, moving forward, this is one of the ways that we can help the communities down there, because as we know, the money is running out. There is going to be ongoing maintenance that still trying to figure out how that's going to happen and how that is significant increase in water rates to residents down there. So passing this and carrying this forward would be one way to recognize that and address that. The work is not done there. there's still more work to be done by many communities, whether it's Hastings, Cottage Grove, Lake Elmo, whatever, and that if we can do this, there can help extend that money for the residents that, you know, you had mentioned how much you're doing to conserve water and the efforts that you've been doing it for a long, long time. And this comes along something that is totally out of your control that kind of throws it to the side. And the side and all the efforts that you've done cannot make up for what's happening with this situation. So thank you for bringing it forward. I hope other members support this because it's going to still be a long-term issue as we deal with PFAS down there, and it's going to be very, very costly, and it's not even coming close to what it's going to deal with down there. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Is there any other discussion on House File 1529? Not seeing any other members. I guess, you know, I just want to say that, you know, you talked about the settlement dollars from 3M, and what we are seeing is that, you know, this corporation that poisoned the water and profited from poisoning the water and then paid a really big settlement to the state, but the settlement is not adequate to meet the cost to the public of this poisoning that we have seen. And, you know, so, I mean, honestly, like, I wish that we weren't having to do this. I wish that Woodbury wasn't having, that, like your residents, the people of Woodbury, whose water was poisoned by one of the biggest corporations in the world, they're going to have to pay for it to clean the water up. And so, you know, it's just really problematic. And you know, I mean, I know that this is an issue that has been worked on over a number of years since I've been in the legislature, certainly. You know, that this settlement was you know, I mean, agreed to by the parties, right? Because we thought it was like the best deal we could get. But this is still a bad deal for the public, and it's a really good deal for 3M that poisoned our drinking water across especially the East Metro. And so, you know, I thank you for coming forward and for, you know, your city and your residents basically stepping up where 3M did not meet its obligations to our communities and to our state. So thank you. And Representative Chai, I don't know if you have anything to close us out, but please go ahead.
Thank you again to this committee for hearing this bill once again. You know, I just wanted to put on the table that it's just not about the families and the children there. It's about the environment. It's about the pets, right? It's about the habitat. So it's about, you know, ensuring that the 90,000 plus Woodbury residents have access to basic drinking water. You know, I had my first child when I was in Woodbury, you know, and here I was as a first-time father taking sink water in 2001 and making baby bottle for my daughter, you know, and this was PFAS wasn't discovered until 2003. And so from 2001 to 2003, I was doing this for my infant child. And that should not happen. And so thank you for listening to this bill. I hope it can be included and it will somewhat, you know, bring some justice to my community. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cha. Thank you, Mayor Burt, for joining us. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1529 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill, and it's laid over. All right. Up next, Representative Kozlowski with House File 443. They'll move that House File 443 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill. Representative Kozlowski, welcome to your committee. Please get settled and go ahead and describe your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. It's great to be here presenting in House File 443 today. This bill is a targeted update to how we tax certain types of airport property in Minnesota. Right now, under our current law, even when local governments own airport property, if it's leased for business purpose, that property is taxed as if it were privately owned. Despite the fact that businesses are already paying fees as well as lease fees to the airport authorities to provide these services that typically are provided by municipality. In my community, we have, you know, the 148th Fighter Wing in our Duluth Airport complex, and they provide first responders, for example. This creates a real disincentive for our communities when we're seeking investments that put us at a competitive disadvantage. And so this bill would simply expand those exemptions to reflect the reality of today's aviation economy. Specifically, it would allow airport hangars used for the manufacturing of airports to qualify for a 50% tax exemption. Manufacturing, as we know, is a really vital part of the aviation ecosystem. And this change will give communities like mine a new tool in the toolbox to spur that job growth and innovation. And so cities under 50,000 also already have this exemption at a full 100% exemption. And so this bill expands that to mid-cities like Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, just recognizing our unique challenges that our regional airports face. And talking with our airports, they have commercial and industrial property right now that could be put to use to create and grow our tax bases. That, you know, challenges that they face that are unique to the large metro areas. So with me today, I have Tom Lerner from the Duluth International Airport. He's the executive director. Just really quickly, we know that in my community, our airport is a economic engine for our region. Our airport is the second busiest hub in the entire state, and it's home to, as I mentioned, the 148th Fighter Wing, to many thriving aerospace and supporting businesses. We also have Lake Superior College right there, growing folks into the aerospace industry and making really massive collective impact with the tenants and the users of our airport. And so to share a little bit more, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier to talk about how when our aviation companies grow and support our businesses, our partners grow and our community grows.
Great. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. And Tom Werner, I believe, is joining us remotely. So please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Gomez and Davids and members of the House Tax Committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tom Werner, Executive Director of the Duluth Airport Authority. I'd also like to thank Representatives Kozlowski, Johnson, Perryman, Scraba, Wogomet, and Zelaznikar for their leadership and advocacy on behalf of this important bipartisan initiative. The aviation cluster centered around the Duluth International Airport produces $1.4 billion in annual economic impact and supports over 4,000 jobs. The community has done a great job of leveraging the airport's infrastructure to create opportunities for large and small employers who provide good-paying jobs that sustain families throughout our community. Economic development is one of the core roles of the Duluth Airport Authority. We work every day to provide the best infrastructure and create a level playing field for businesses who would choose the Duluth International Airport as their home for their operation, whether it be aeronautical or non-aeronautical in nature. We compete against communities and airports all over the country trying to attract businesses and the job opportunities that come with them. Making sure we have good tools in the toolkit to ensure our competitiveness is important. House File 443 is one such tool. Inspired by the current tax exemption for an airport in a city with a population less than 50,000 when property is leased for certain uses, at airports with a population greater than 50,000, leased property is taxed. The tax is paid on top of whatever the entity is paying the airport authority to lease and fees associated with maintaining the airport. From a business's perspective, this represents double taxation, which can make economic development attraction difficult. House File 443 would exempt airport leased property from property taxes at a rate of 50% in communities with a population of 50,000 to 150,000 for a period of 10 years. For the Duluth International Airport, this provides another tool in the economic development toolkit as we work to expand our aviation cluster, supporting the growth of existing aviation businesses and attraction of new ones. Airport development allows airport authorities like the Duluth Airport Authority to be financially self-sustaining through lease and operating fees. This reduces the burden on the state aeronautics fund and local property taxpayers in communities where an airport operating subsidy is provided. I urge your support for House File 443. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Moving now to member discussion. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just be quick. Thank you, Rep. Kozlowski. So this does affect my city, obviously, that has a metropolitan airport with this language. Our city is neutral on this. I actually just want to praise both the advocates and Rep. Kozlowski, we are very quick to point out when people don't keep us on the loop on things, but this team has done a really good job of keeping Rochester and its representatives in the loop on this, even when we don't have an official position. So I just want to say publicly, we appreciate that. And thank you for your work on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Maybe House Research could help me out here, because this bill for Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester would put it down to 50%, but I believe that if you have an airport in a city of under 50,000, it's 100% exemption. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, the only change in this bill affecting airports owned by a city with a population of less than 50,000 is the portion related to the manufacturing, hangars used for the manufacture of aircraft. So under current law, if an airport property is owned by a city with a population of less than 50,000, the check-in area is already exempt from property taxes. The change in this bill to exempt manufacturing facilities would be the only portion that would impact cities with a population under 50,000.
Chair Davids.
But thank you very much, Mr. Swanson. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is a really good bill, and I was looking at authors, and it says Kozlowski and others. I hope I'm one of the others. It says Kozlowski, Johnson, Pease, Lesnikar, Scraba, Walgamott, and others. Maybe Ms. Goblers, you could check to see if I'm an other. And if I'm not an other, I would like to be an other with that. Now, I've got to be a little careful here. This is Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester. This is a very, very good bill, and I'm supporting it 100%. Rochester may be neutral, but Greg Davids is not neutral. This may be my Rochester vote for the year. I'll get primaried, but
kind of used.
Yeah, that happens.
Too soon, Representative.
Too soon. So I think moving this forward, I don't know if you've been up to Duluth tour. I'm sure you have. You've probably been to Duluth.
They've been to Duluth once or twice.
Toured the Cirrus plant and so forth. It's just very impressive. And if we can help Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester, I'm all in on this one. I think it's a great bill you have, and I hope to become one of the others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
I don't mean to speak after the chair, Madam Chair, but I think it's also an important fact that these airports that you're mentioning are keys to patient access around the state. Yep. The bottom line is especially this time of year in the fall, we have adverse weather where the helicopters can't land or can't fly, and so these airports also help us evacuate or bring patients to, like Duluth. So I really appreciate them bringing the bill, and I am also going to go on the bill, Chair Davis.
All right, looks like we have others lining up here. Okay, is there any further member discussion? Seeing none, I'll go back to Representative Kozlowski if you have any closing comments for us.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Gomez and members. I've been recently watching Lost, so I appreciate the others' comments. I'll note that. I work for the city of Duluth when pandemic times and really the kind of a downturn and tumultuous time for our aerospace industry, which we're really grateful that we are a premier hub for. And so I don't take it lightly, bringing a bill forward for exempting and shifting property taxes onto residents. I think one thing I just want to make sure that when we're talking about, the letters of support in the packet from the cities of St. Cloud, Duluth, counties, and many partners, that the shift, when you take an account for commercial properties across the state of that $460,000 that would be shifted, is about a dollar impact, which is still meaningful for residents. But when we look at the economic impact, this is going to be a win-win for ultimately generating and allow our communities to grow and expand and thrive into the future. So I appreciate your support.
Thank you very much, Representative Kozlowski. It pleases our tax nerd hearts when people acknowledge that we're doing property tax shifts. So thank you for that, even if it's like for a worthy cause, we have to weigh those different aspects of it. So with that, Representative Kozlowski will renew their motion that House File 443 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill, and it's laid over. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. We're gonna push the 2257 my bill till the end, and so we're gonna go to Representative Lee if you're ready. Perfect. So Representative Lee has House File 2499, and she will move that House File 2499 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Lee, yeah, Mr. Dahl can come forward, and Ms. Madden, you're on deck. I guess there's three chairs. You guys can probably all go snuggle up there. Representative Lee, to your bill.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Appreciate that we're having this discussion today. So just very quickly, House File 2499 would expand the renter's credit to ensure parity in property tax refunds for renters, just like we provide for homeowners with the homestead credit. And since we have some new members, I want to remind folks that the changes that we made in the 2023 tax bill mean that the renter's credit is now a refundable income tax credit to renters whose rent and implicit property taxes are high relative to their incomes. The homestead credit is a state-paid refund to homeowners whose property taxes are also high relative to their incomes. So what does parity for renters, for the renter's credit mean if we were to bring it up to where the homestead credit is? This is where House File 2499 comes in. It first would nearly double the income cutoff for claimants by increasing it from $75,389 to $143,140, which is where the current cutoff is for the homestead credit. And then the second thing you do is raise the maximum credit to $3,500, just like the homestead credit. And this would be almost a $1,000 increase from the current level of $2,640 for the renter's credit. And in your packets, I direct you to the revenue note that shows increasing the household income range to the same level as the homestead credit would result in an estimated additional 80,000 renters who would qualify for this credit. The revenue note also tells us this is probably not a bill we can pay for in the current year, but it's important for us to ask ourselves why, or how we can close this inequity between renters and homeowners when both groups pay property taxes. And this is important because the renter's credit is a very effective tool to target assistance to the state's lowest income households. In 2022, 64% of households receiving the renter's credit had incomes of $40,000 or less. 30% of households who received this credit in 2022 also included senior citizens or people living with disabilities. Their average credit was $1,125, which was a higher average than the average claim statewide, showing how important this is to our seniors and neighbors living with disabilities. And in the handout in your packets from the Minnesota Budget Project, you'll see the runs of how much went to each county in tax year 2022. And while certainly the seven county metro area had a lot of claimants, on par, I think if you look at the average claim amount, it's pretty sizable in certain places across the state that you would not imagine. I'd also like to point out that the share of participating households that includes seniors or people living with disabilities is actually higher in Greater Minnesota. And we know this because in 20 Greater Minnesota counties, at least half the participating households included seniors or people living with disabilities. And so that's just an overview for me. Next, I'd like to yield to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And Representative Lee was referring to this document from the Minnesota Budget Project. It's really very interesting. Please check it out. Find your county. You'll see kind of that, I think people have like perceptions about who gets the renter's credit. It's really, it's certainly working families with kids, but it's a lot of seniors and folks with disabilities depending on where you're at across the state. So thank you, Representative Lee. Mr. Dahl. Nan Madden, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. I'm just going to share some additional background information on the renter's credit. As Representative Lee mentioned, Minnesota has property tax refunds for both homeowners and renters. For renters, it's often called the renter's credit. And it recognizes the fact that while certainly it's the owners of a rental property that are responsible for paying the property taxes on that building, renters contribute to paying that property taxes through their rents. And for purposes of the renter's credit, it's assumed that 17% of the rent, 17% of the rent that renters have paid is considered going towards property taxes. So it, both the homeowner and renter's property tax refunds essentially put a kind of put a cap on how much of a household's income can go towards property taxes. To qualify, renting households must have incomes below income limits, which for 2022 was about $70,000. The assumed share of their rent that is property taxes has to exceed a certain percentage of their income. So these are folks who are considered to be paying property taxes that are high for their income level. And then the housing that they live in needs to be paying property taxes or a payment in lieu of taxes to local governments. I also want to lift up some exciting changes to the renter's credit that were passed in 2023 and are in effect for the first time this filing year, which are meant to simplify the application process and expand the number of low and moderate income Minnesotans who receive their renter's credit. So this year, for the first time, Minnesotans will apply for their renter's credit, as Representative Lee mentioned, when they file their state income tax return. So previously, this application was a separate property tax refund application that was due in August. That's a time when there is less tax prep assistance available, so it can be harder for renters to get those refunds in. And secondly, the definition of a household's income for qualifying for and calculating the credit has been simplified. It is now based on a household's adjusted gross income, which is a measure that many other provisions of our tax law are based on, rather than a broader and much more complicated household income definition that was used previously. Some of the expected outcomes from this shift from a standalone application to putting the renter's credit on the income tax form is that it will increase participation among renters who already were eligible but were not able to manage the process of applying. It gets refunds out to renters much earlier in the year because of being synced with the income tax filing process. And some more renters will qualify, and some renters will get a larger property tax refund. In conclusion, I just want to thank Representative Lee for her attention to the differences in property tax refunds between homeowners and renters. Sometimes those differences have a good policy reason, and sometimes they appear to be more arbitrary. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Dahl.
Good morning, co-chairs Gomez and Davids and members of the committee. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Public Policy Director with Homeline, a statewide tenant advocacy organization. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2499. It's always been puzzling to me that there hasn't been a parity between tenants and homeowners with respect to the renter's credit and the homestead credit. So I want to thank you, Representative Lee, for being the chief author for this bill, which finally proposes fairness between the two. Let's face it, low-income renters are struggling to make it. According to the Minnesota Housing Partnership Report, State of the State's Housing 2024, the median rent increased by 8% in just 1 year, the largest increase in the past decade. Also, for several decades, renters have grappled with housing costs that have been rising in faster than their wages. This is exacerbated by a significant lack of supply. Minnesota is just short of 114,000 units of housing that are not available for or available for extremely low-income households. Well, these needs are issues that housing committees need to address. I want to say that there's no denying that the renter's credit provides essential help to struggling tenant households. By raising the maximum credit and income limits, more renters will have additional funds to cover basic necessities. Homeline speaks with renters regularly about what they use the renter's credit for. They use it to purchase items like school supplies and their kids' clothes and to get a head start on holiday gifts for the family. They also use this to obtain new eyeglasses or take an overdue trip to the dentist. They stock up on household supplies and non-perishable groceries and take some time to catch up on overdue bills. They've also told us that they use this to get car repairs done. These are major expenses. They're also basic necessities that renters have that compete with their housing costs. So to see this relief is something that is very much welcomed. Achieving parity between the renter's credit and the homestead credit is not only fair, it will help households struggling to make ends meet move closer to stability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. Moving now, are there to member discussion? Are there comments or questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When people are making decisions about buying houses, they look at everything. They look at the deductibility of mortgage interest. They look at just the whole cost structure, because it isn't just, when you're buying a house, it isn't just what the payment is, it's everything else that's included. And I think we, from a public policy standpoint, should be trying to encourage people to buy homes. We know that that's a much more stable thing. That's what people want. And so by, you know, there's, if anything, I would do the opposite. I would increase the credit for the homestead for lower income families. So I just want to point that out. There's reason for this, and we should be, we're going to get, whatever we do with taxes, we're going to get more of what we incentivize. I want to incentivize homeownership. So that's, I would be opposed to this bill on that basis. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lee, or we don't have to respond. That was more of a statement, I guess. All right. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lee, thank you for bringing this bill. As you know, I'm a realtor, and I do see incentives in this bill as a realtor that where I do my farming, that's what we call it, is I go to those people that are living in apartments or rental housing, and I see if they're ready, if they're set to buy a home. And by doing that, we also look at their finances, like my friend across the aisle said, and we look at the whole picture. And realistically, there is no way to buy a house for no money down. So I think this program would let them put money in reserve and move forward with, if they choose to buy a house, not for everybody, but if they choose to buy a house. And then I think we have a number of incentives for homeowners, and there are state mortgage deductions, stuff like that. So I really appreciate it, and I understand your line of thought, Representative, but I think this is a great bill, and it will help us move the housing market a little bit, too.
Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's funny, the microphone just fell apart. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for Madam Chair, and Representative Hewitt, it's already been a long morning, for bringing the perspective of the real estate market, because as we know, especially from many of the bills moving through our committees right now, that we have a lack of housing and lack of affordable housing, especially for folks to buy. I have three kids in their 20s. I'm very lucky that one was able to buy a house here, but it was a struggle to find something in their price range. So it's a yes and. We have to do all of it. But I want to particularly point out something that Representative Lee pointed out, is that 30% of our folks that are in rentals are folks that are seniors or folks with disabilities. So a lot of our seniors as well, not just the ones that are in rental, are looking to downsize. And trying to find a smaller house to downsize into is also almost nearly impossible for their price range. So a lot of our seniors, like my parents, have downsized into an apartment and should be able to take advantage of this credit. That's why it needs to be beefed up. So the housing market is struggling right now in having enough capacity for folks that want to choose how they live and where they live. So anything we can do to help that out would be great. Thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this conversation forward.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Representative Lee. The question I have is, how does this guarantee or that landlords or property owners will not just see this, they have more opportunity to pay more rent? How do we prevent this from not just ending up in landlords' pockets?
Representative Lee?
I think the argument is, it already does, right? So when you pay your rent, you pay implicit property taxes.
Representative Johnson?
I guess, thank you, Chair Gomez. I guess the question is this is going to increase the credit for property taxes paid, in my understanding. So that means they have more money coming back to them. How does the landlord not just say, oh, well, they now have $1,000 or $1,500 more in their pocket now because of this rental credit, that they don't just say, oh, now we have an opportunity to raise the rent and it doesn't result in rent inflation?
Representative Lee?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So this is a common thing that people ask, and I would just say, you know, the housing market is broken. I want to go back to addressing one of, you know, Rep. Anderson's points. Home ownership is increasingly out of reach for Minnesotans, right? And so when we look at housing as a continuum, whether it's buying a house or renting or, you know, shacking up with your in-laws, housing is out of reach for folks. And so this is one of the tools that we have to fix a market that is failing folks. And certainly, yes, there are really bad landlords that do that. But we also know that, you know, in that market also tops out, right? And so that could happen. But we're also hoping that this tool that we are implementing would help correct for in the market.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Johnson, I will just say that the calculation for the renter's credit is based on, you know, the percentage of the rent paid that is implicitly goes to property taxes and the tenant's income. And so, I mean, I don't know, that'd have to be a pretty crafty landlord to try to figure out the calculation of, like, what is the tenant's income and what's their credit going to be, and then jack up the rent. I mean, hopefully people aren't doing that, but we don't have a lot of mechanisms to control rent, it turns out. Representative Johnson, did you have anything further on that?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and to Representative Lee and team for bringing this bill forward. Coming from the Housing Committee, and I think we should be talking about housing in every committee, I really support efforts like this that are going to make sure that we're uplifting and boosting renters, which is very much a valid form of housing. As somebody who grew up in all kinds of rental units as a kid, and, you know, I'm lucky now to have been a first-gen homeowner, to the points that were made earlier about, you know, helping folks that we have 114,000 unit shortage, especially for our most deeply affordable housing. And, you know, 50% of our renters are cost burdened. In the latest report from Minnesota Housing Partnership that put out that, you know, it's most especially impacting our rural singles, seniors, families, and, you know, average rent increase because of our shortage and because of cost inflations that renters are bearing the brunt off of their back. The average rent increase has been $1,200. And so I think that's already happening, that renters are being siphoned, that the average age of owning a home is 38 years old. And so being able to build up that nest egg, being able to have a place to lay your head and dream and build a life. But also, not everybody wants to live in a home. People want to live in rental units. They want to live in townhomes and condos. And one of the things that your testifier up here is with the tenant hotline that we've been working on. And I think, if I recall, that the certificates for rent paid were one of the things that increasingly are coming up in these efforts to make sure that tenants and landlords understand their rights and responsibilities, but that requests for certificates for rent paid and to be able to access these tax credits is coming up and bubbling to the surface. And I'm just curious if you can talk about how the efforts are being done to make sure that folks know that this credit's available and to claim it, and then what more would be done in expanding these opportunities.
I'll go to Representative Lee. I also, I don't know if the testifiers have thoughts on that last question of Representative Kozlowski's. Rep. Lee.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. So after we enacted the 2023 tax bill, I know Commissioner Marquardt came and kind of did a recap. I believe there are a number of things that the department has been doing, one of which is this certificates of rents paid. There is now an electronic system that they are trying to convince a lot of landlords to, I guess, join. It's a voluntary process right now. I forget if we're going to move to make it mandatory, but basically, right, like, if you're a renter, your landlord would, like, mail you this piece of paper certifying how much rent you've paid in the past year. If we make it electronic, that's much easier. And then the fact that we changed the renter's credit to be part of your income tax has been really helpful, because a lot of people did not know they had to do this, you know, random form in like at the end of summer and read like 30 pages of a guideline to fill out to get this money that they were entitled to. And so there are a bunch of folks that have been doing outreach on that. And then one of the things that has been really helpful is us funding VITA sites, right, and making sure that, you know, these sites across the state are helping people understand that this is a credit that they are entitled to.
Thank you, Representative Lee. So I'll just add, like, the excuse me, we heard a bill about increasing that support for tax preparation and tax outreach. And so in we included money for that in the 23 bill, and in 2024 we didn't really like do our tax bill as such, but we included the advanced payments for the child tax credit, and so we also included some of that tax outreach assistance dollars in 2024, and we certainly can do more, but you know, I think sort of round one of that in 23 was really focused on the child tax credit. Round two of that, the 2024 funding, was focused on advance payments for child tax credit and this conversion of the renter's credit. But, you know, to your point, and I mean, and Representative Lee and Ms. Madden talked about this, you know, the change that we made to the renter's credit, we didn't change the parameters of the program at all, but by switching it to a refundable income tax credit, we're just making it so that tens of thousands, I mean, I can't remember the exact number, it might be 100,000 renters who are entitled to the credit, they believe will claim it now. But your point about, you know, ensuring that when we do big changes to tax policy, like, we have to be able to figure out how to communicate that to regular people who are, you know, going to be filing their taxes is a good one. And we've taken steps in this committee to try to do that support and be like mindful of, you know, both like the department doing a lot of outreach and also like partnering with community organizations to push that outreach forward. But we need to continue that effort. And Ms. Madden or Mr. Dahl, or I don't know if both of you guys want to go. We'll go to Ms. Madden. Go first.
Sure. Thank you for that question, and Madam Chair, the fiscal estimate for the policy change to move the renter's credit onto the income tax form, Department of Revenue estimated that that change would result in nearly 120,000 more households who were eligible starting to claim that renter's credit for which they already qualified. And maybe I'll add also that I believe the department has a proposal in this year's governor's plan to make sure that landlords are getting that certificate of rent paid out to renters, as that's an essential piece of information that renters need to file for this renter's credit.
Thank you. Mr. Dahl.
Chair Gomez and Representative Kozlowski, I wanted to point out that Homeline is actually one of the organizations that is being partnered with the two Department of Revenue Resources. We take 20,000 calls each year. Many of them are extremely low-income households, and we tell everybody who calls us what it is that they're entitled to as part of the renter's credit. And so we are doing that outreach to thousands of renters, letting them know that that this change has happened in the law and could feasibly be done, and that there's also an increase in resources available through the changes that Representative Lee is proposing.
That's great. Thank you, Mr. Dahl. Is there further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Just quickly. That part of the tax bill was a good part of the tax bill. So,
Thanks.
Because it was very complicated for people to. I've been both a landlord in the past, and I did my kids' renter's credits on their taxes. and it's very complicated historically. And I think the electronic is a really good system too, because it is, you know, you're going to get a lot more people, small landlords, to do that way. So thank you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Anderson. I'll go to you for final comments, but I wanted to just say a couple things.
Sure.
You know, first of all, I was glad that Chair Joaquin kind of shared the experience of her family, because it speaks to an issue, and Representative Kozlowski spoke to this also, but, you know, housing is a continuum. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have, you know, places for seniors who have raised their family in a house that's maybe too big for them, when there's nowhere for them to go, they don't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then that house, you know, that might have been a good starter home for another family is not available to them. And this is an issue about supply all along the continuum of housing. And, you know, I think that housing is actually a place where we can find a lot of common ground across other kind of ideological differences that we might have in this body. I'm really encouraged to see some of the bipartisan work about increasing housing supply all along the continuum of housing that's happening. And, you know, you talked about the mortgage interest deduction and that is a calculation that people sometimes take into account when they're considering actions, you know, whether they're going to buy a house or not. But I just really, I need to continue to point out that the last time I saw, since we doubled the standard deduction, 96% of people take the standard deduction. It doesn't make sense for them to itemize. And so we are still spending $80 million a year. It goes up, I mean, in the tax expenditure budget, I think the 29 numbers, maybe more around $125 million a year, right, to subsidize mortgages for some of those 4% of people who itemize deductions. And so we have to ask ourselves, are the top 4% of earners, are they making decisions about when to buy property based on this tax preference that they're getting? Is that the best way for us to spend $80 to $125 million if we were trying to open up opportunities for home ownership, which I think we all agree is good for people, it's good for families, it's good for generational wealth, it's an important thing. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that we have a very high home ownership rate overall in Minnesota. One of the highest in the country. But we also have one of the deepest disparities, especially between Black people and Native people and white people, in home ownership rates. And so, and, you know, there are tens of thousands of Minnesotans across the state, in all parts of our state, who make enough money to own a home, to buy a home, to pay off a mortgage, who have the credit that they need. And they don't have that critical down payment, right? And a lot of people don't want to talk about it, but if you're a middle-class person or an upper-middle-class person, there's almost certainly somebody in your family who is able to help you if you're a young person, you know, to come up with that down payment. And a lot of people do not have that kind of support. And so, you know, in 2023, Representative Kozlowski was also, you know, I'm sure a bunch of members were on the housing committee, but we did the first generation homebuyer down payment assistance. I think it was like $100 million, but it was one-time money. But here we are spending $100 million ongoing to subsidize mortgage interest for the 4% of people who itemize their deductions. And I think that we really need to take a look at that. It's something that's in the purview of the tax committee. And if we share the goal of moving more people into home ownership, you know, there's money that we're already spending in this area that's not going to, that I would argue is not kind of going to that shared goal of increasing home ownership opportunities for people who otherwise have been boxed out of them. But sorry, that's not the topic of this bill, but it's a little bit of a personal pet concern of mine. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Chair Dean.
I thought you were filibustering when you have the gavel.
I sometimes do a little bit of a weave when I speak, and Chair Davids thinks I'm filibustering, but maybe. Okay, Representative Lee, any final comments on your bill?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I really appreciate the discussion, and I mean, I think, like I talked about, housing is a continuum. I think if there's two things to take away from today's discussion, it's first, renters pay property taxes, and as Mr. Dahl highlighted, there is an affordability crisis in renting, and like we heard from Rep, or in the discussion here, there's also a home ownership crisis. And so, you know, for us, we need to do more. We are doing a lot for homeowners. We should do more for renters, as that is an emergent need. And then the second thing is, very clearly, like, this is a policy decision. According to my research, the legislature enacted our property tax refund program in 1975. And in 1983, they set the income limit at $40,000 for both homeowners and renters. And since then, the legislature has made numerous changes to our PTR program for both homeowners and renters. But, you know, something I'd like to point out, and I know Chair Davids does not like inflators, is when, coincidentally, right, when you look at, you know, the income cutoff for homeowners for the Homestead credit, it's pretty close to keeping up with inflation. We've actually outperformed that $40,000. But for renters, we have not. And so this is very clearly a policy decision that we can make here. I'd also note that, you know, In 2022, when we elected the most diverse freshman class in race, in sexual orientation, and also economic, I guess, well-being, right? There are more renters in the legislature now than there ever have been. And so I think we should ask ourselves why, you know, this very important population, you know, has not been helped versus all the other homeowners who have been in the legislature for a very long time. So with that, I will close.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Chair Davids, you good? All right. With that, Representative Lee will renew her motion that House File 2499 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill, and it is laid over. Thank you so much. All right. Up next, Chair Herr, House File 1522. All right. Representative Herr is going to move that House File 1522 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill. Chair Herr, I understand you have an amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, please, Madam Chair, if I can move that amendment. It's just a technical amendment.
All right. Looks like a date change. Is there any discussion on the A1 to House File 1522? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries. The A1 is adopted. House File 1522 is in the form the author would like. Chair Herr, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And thank you, Chair Davids and Chair Gomez, both for hearing the bill today. House File 1522, which would allow small farmers to qualify for the agricultural homestead tax credit. I appreciate the committee's consideration. And this bill, what it does is that it helps our very small farmers, those cultivating and earning an income on less than 11 contiguous acres, and how they can benefit from the Ag Homestead Credit. This is important because these small farmers are often beginning farmers who could use this relief. And they're also often farmers close to urban and suburban areas where they're struggling to compete with residential development. Much like for the midsize and larger farms who benefit from Ag Homestead, it will limit their tax burden, helping them hold on to that land and continue to help feed our communities and our state. I will point out that their fiscal note is negligible, and so there's just a small shift. I know that that is important to this committee. I will just say that I can go over the details of the bill, but I think just briefly that it does offer two pathways to be able to show that you are earning income and that you are an actual working farm, so that we don't just allow anybody who might grow vegetables to claim this Ag Homestead credit. And with that, I do want to turn it over to my testifier, Kelsey. She and I got a chance to get to know each other through the Farmers Union. I'm also a proud Farmers Union member. And I actually learned of this bill through her, and I felt very strongly that this is something important that we should do if we want to support small farmers. And so she's going to share her story and how she is earning her living on 5 acres. And so I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Kelsey.
All right, Kelsey Zavedra, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record as you get started.
Thank you. Good morning,
co-chairs Gomez and Davids, and members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Zavedra. I'm the president of the Chisago County Farmers Union, and I'm glad to share our strong support for Representative Hur's bill that allows small farmers like me to participate in the Ag Homestead Tax Credit. I'm especially happy to be here today. I was in a very serious car accident last year, so I don't get out much. So really glad to be here in support of this. So I'm a specialty crop farmer. So I grow fruit, vegetables, herbs, things that you eat. Most of what I grow is sold direct to consumers. I sell through my farm store, at the Mill City Farmers Market, and through our newly formed cooperative. Farming is my full-time job. My farm's just 5 acres. And I don't have 5 acres because that was my goal. It's land is expensive, and it was all I could get. I wanted to buy a much larger farm, but accessing land is a significant barrier to many young and beginning farmers. It's a massive barrier that we're all facing. We're currently losing 2,000 acres of farmland a day to development, and young people are actively leaving agriculture because we simply cannot compete. Fortunately, it's possible to have an intensive operation on a very small parcel of land like mine. Many young and beginning farmers are now doing this as a way to make a living from the land. That being said, we are not recognized as farmers. And that's and we're not recognized with this tax law strictly due to the size of our farms. I was told that if I wanted to get agricultural tax status, that the only way I could obtain it was to purchase an additional 6 acres in a 4-township radius. So missing out on this tax credit is important to me. I'm operating on a very slim profit margin, and property taxes are significant. So I really appreciate Representative Hur's work on this bill and the time she's taken to visit with me and other farmers about this issue. Keeping farmland taxes affordable will help keep me and others on the land. So today I'm speaking in support of this bill so that all farmers, no matter the size of our farms, so that we can enjoy the benefits we deserve. We work really hard to feed our communities and we value your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else present who wishes to testify? Chair Davids is so good about asking that. I forgot every time today, so sorry about that. Somebody probably would have hopped up if they needed to, I assume. Not seeing any. Is there any member discussion? Representative Harder and then Representative Anderson next. Sorry. Go ahead, Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Representative Hur, my question, I just have one question. But I do agree, farming is difficult. And margins are extremely tight, and we have no control over what the cost is to even get that crop to grow. But my question is, how did you pick the amount of $5,000?
Yeah. So
Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, Representative Harder, for that question. So we chose $5,000 because we wanted to ensure that beginning farmers could be eligible as they're building their businesses. And while $5,000 might not seem like a lot, it would be a lot of cucumbers to grow, a lot of vegetables. I don't know how many people go to farmers market and if you've ever bought. But it's so affordable to be able to buy from farmers market, which means that farmers are working really hard and they're selling their produce for prices that I think you have to actually sell a lot of produce to get to $5,000. I know I have like maybe a 3/4 acre garden and I make almost nothing from that. I've tried and nobody buys my stuff. It's really good though. I don't know why. I need some help. But to get to that $5,000 threshold, I think as a small business can still be challenging, but we thought that that would be a good place to start. And I'm always willing to adjust that if people think there's a different figure that we should be looking at. But thank you for the question, Representative Harder.
Representative Harder, anything else?
That's all. That was my only question. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you think about a minimum acreage? I mean, I was surprised that there's no minute, so it could be 1/4 acre lots in a city. It could be, you know, did you think about 5 acres or 2.5 or something where it's actually more rural?
You Representative Hur.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Gomez. You'd think as a chair I'd remember to go through the chair, but Representative Anderson, that's actually a really good question. I did not think about that because, you know, the truth is I think it depends on the type of agriculture that you are growing, that you may need more land, less land, and I didn't want to personally limit it because I don't know what people are growing. I think I spoke with someone.
You didn't have to go ahead.
I do.
Okay.
So maybe Kelsey can answer, because Kelsey grows garlic, and I was floored by the fact that, like, she grows one thing and she's able to sustain her farm. And so I think that that also played a factor in, like, not putting in a minimum, but just letting anyone less than 11 acres. So Kelsey, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, Ms. Saavedra.
Yes, thank you. I think it, as a specialty crop farmer, I grow a lot of different things, and the soil tells me what I can grow. So if you have a particular type of soil, you might be limited to grow over, like, only five different crops and a whole bunch of them. And so limiting this to, did you say land?
Yeah.
Yeah, limiting it to land is limiting, especially in the way that agriculture is moving. Like, as the state of Minnesota, we're top five in the nation for agriculture. And so this is a way to invest in our agriculture system by supporting young farmers and not limiting them on what they can grow.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. My question was about the size. So there's no, it's under 11 acres, mm-hmm. but there's no, it could be a quarter acre. It could be an eighth of an acre. It could be a townhome backyard. It could be.
Yeah.
So that my question is to the author.
Thoughts
about that.
Representative Hurt. And I will note, this is being laid over, so I mean, I think this is a really good good line of questioning, and that we should think about it as we're moving forward. But Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I think that part of the reason why, and that is actually a factor that we looked at, because there's a good reason for that. We're not allowing just anyone who plants vegetables or a garden to get a tax break. And that's why there's that 5,000 and then the two pathways to ensuring that people are showing that they have income from this. So, like, you might have a quarter acre, like, you know, my mom lives in North St. Paul and she has a little garden, but, like, she would never be able to produce $5,000 worth of goods from that. So, like, I think instead of looking at just, like, the size of the lot, that's why it's the $5,000 in gross income, and that you have to produce a Schedule F that shows that. And then the second way is that if you're a new farmer and you don't have any taxes yet, that you have the ability to show that you're going to have a plan to earn $5,000 in the gross income. And so that's why that threshold that Representative Harder talked about is more important than just the size, because somebody can, you know, depending on the produce, can grow that $5,000 and some can't. And if you are able to demonstrate that, you can. I also think, I don't know if maybe Stu from the Farmers Union could maybe answer this, but, like, I know that you also have to be, like, my farm, when I was looking for my 5-acre farm, there's a lot of property out there, but they're not zoned as ag. And I specifically bought my farm because it is zoned as ag, because I wanted to be able to produce. And so there's some other, you know, factors that sort of play into that. So I don't know if maybe that answers your question or not, or if maybe Stu from the Farmers Union could provide any more insight into it.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, Co-Chair Davids. Stu Laurie, Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. Don't know that I have a ton to add. I think it's a good question. I think I just echo that it always surprises me in finding members who are earning a genuine income in agriculture on smaller and smaller parcels of land. The other piece, I think, in your package, you have a letter from the Twin Cities Agricultural Land Trust. They're an organization that's working to preserve small amounts of farmland for folks who are working to engage in agriculture in the Twin Cities. And I think they'd have a really informed perspective on what some of those farmers are facing and how they think that this would benefit them as well.
Representative Anderson? Great, thank you. Representative Sudzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a quick question on the bill. Just kind of looking from a perspective, looking at paragraph 2.24 and 2.27, that area of purpose of paragraph market farming, and it just kind of from a production of animal or other products and then $5,000 gross income, is there any definition that talks that the property actually had to, you know, when I'm thinking of a cow, like if you think of a beef cow, you know, from market rate standpoints, you know, you have two cows that you sell, butcher, you know, I could go out and buy a 1,000-pound cow, put 200 pounds on it in a couple of months, and then sell it and do that two times. Would that constitute that would qualify under this tax provision?
Representative Herr?
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, Representative Sozinski, for that question. I've thought about that because I did butcher two beef cows last year, and I thought, would I qualify for this? I did think about that, but I think that question was brought up, and could that just be the case? But farmers would need to be market farming, which is defined in statute, and also they'd employ the same process through which they determine whether someone farming 12, 40, 200 acres are eligible for this tax credit. So, like, you can't just, like, I always say that I am a farmer because I do grow and I do have animals, but I just wouldn't be able to say, well, I butchered two cows last year and now I qualify for this, that I, you know, would still have to provide the proper documentation, and also that, like I said, market farming and egg is defined in statute and they would have to comply with that.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following that kind of line of, so just putting a scenario there, so would market farming, if I, let's say I did that, but I did market it. So I took a Facebook page ad out and said, hey, beef for sale. So I not only, I did that, butchered it, took it to a local USDA approved butcher, and then I just sold beef packages either to buddies at a quarter a time or whatever. Would that qualify me for that? Is that fit within that definition?
Representative Herr?
Chair Gomez, Representative Swedzinski, and I may let just me Stu address that. I know that I've thought about it, and actually the process isn't as easy as just doing that because there are like quality control that you have to go through. There has to be like inspections and packaging and all of these things that I don't know how to comply with, so I couldn't just do that. And whoever is savvy enough to be able to navigate that, they could probably be savvy enough to get themselves fit the state statute to be able to do it. But I'm going to let maybe Stu just provide a finer point on that than just Kali Herr's experience in Farm 6.
Mr. Lurie.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Thank you, Representative. And thanks for the opportunity to discuss this previously, too. So I think what this removes is the requirement that a property be exclusively engaged in, or extensively, I think is the word used in statute, engaged in market farming, but they'd still need to be engaged in market farming. And so, you know, I'm not an assessor, right? But the assessor would need to go to the property, confirm that it's agricultural in nature, that there's that work happening on the property. I would think for cattle, you know, is there a loafing shed and is there fencing and are they, you know, really engaged in that in addition to selling that beef cattle into the local market? According to this bill, they would also need to, of course, file a Schedule F with the federal government showing that tax income and show that as well. And I think just to put that point too, I mean, I think this wouldn't be a totally new process for the assessors because if there's a 12-acre parcel, they'd be doing the same process to confirm that it's agricultural in nature and engaged in market farming. So thank you.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. Just from just kind of analyzing the this bill, I think it's just worthy to talk about the fact that this bill is going to be it makes it easier to achieve that, but because of Trump's work on egg prices, if you just got chickens, you're gonna have to sell a lot more eggs to make $5,000 because the price of eggs are going down since Trump took office.
Surprised you want to talk about Trump's work on egg prices, but certainly we could do that. Representative Herr?
No, I have no comments to that. I don't know if there's any additional number of questions, but I will just wrap it up by saying that I actually this year, so I use a tax advisor who like works with me in preparing my taxes. And I said to him, hey, I'm a small farm and I want to see if I qualify for all these, you know, like tax credits and write-offs. And to be honest, it's actually really hard to cheat the system. And so, you know, like he said to me, not that I was trying to cheat the system.
She would never cheat the system. I want the record to reflect.
Yes. And I have a feeling that people think that somehow if you allow people under. And the truth is that, you know, the way our tax laws are written, the way state statute is written, is really hard. And my tax guy advised me, he said, I don't think it's worth you saving a couple bucks to like try to navigate this system with what you've done. But I did sell a couple of beef cows and a couple of pigs, and I did erase some money from chicken, my eggs, because eggs are really expensive. And Representative Swedzinski and I will have to agree to disagree that the Trump's work is helping agriculture. But I will say that this does really help those who need it, and we want our small farmers to stay. I want to be able to buy fresh produce from small farmers like Kelsey, and that requires that the help that they need in order to stay viable in this market. So I just appreciate the committee's time and the consideration. So thank you, Chair Gomez and Chair Davids, for hearing the bill today.
Thank you very much. With that, Chair Herr will renew her motion that House File 1522, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 tax bill, and it's laid over. I'm going to pass the gavel over to Vice Chair Norris. Before I do so, I just wanted to note that if you look in your packets for 1522, you'll find a memorandum from the Department of Revenue. And that document actually goes along with House File 2257, which we're about to hear. So, thanks.
Do I move my bill right now?
Oh, I'll move it up there. Okay. Sorry.
We're figuring it out.
All right, Chair Gomez, as you get settled, would you like to move House File 2257?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
All right, Chair Gomez moves that House File 2257 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2025 House Taxes Bill. Chair Gomez, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 2257, this mic is so much more echoey. Okay, is an answer to the Alliance v. Hennepin court case from 2024. So this case held that when a charity operates, this particular charity, that they have some low-income housing, Alliance does, for people, you know, it's income limited. A lot of their clients are people coming out of homelessness. They do very good work. They, traditionally, it's been, even nonprofit operators have had property tax liability for rental property, for low-income rental property. And so it's been assessed, and then kind of, you know, the class rate's been applied, and it's been, you know, had to liable for property taxes. So those nonprofit landlords have been liable for the property, for property taxes. Alliance tried to get tax exemption for some of their housing. The Hennepin County assessors said no. They appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said this housing is core to their charitable mission, and so thus it's exempt. In state statute, it says that basically the memo that I pointed you to is the Department of Revenue's interpretation of state statute, which basically holds that, you know, that somebody's liable for the property taxes, and in this case where the landlord is an exempt entity, the tenants then would be liable for personal property taxes on their apartment, and so that's kind of what the memo says. This, of course, is pretty problematic because you have, you know, low-income renters who, you know, I think Mr. Hoagland's going to come up, the assessor from Hennepin County, but he told me that, you know, because of this interpretation of by the department that valuation note, or basically like bills have gone out to low-income tenants saying you owe property taxes for your apartment. So House File 2257 basically aims to address this issue by declaring that in the court case, they kind of talked about like, hey, the legislature probably should deal with this in one way or another. So this is an attempt for the legislature to deal with this. what the bill says is that, you know, low-income rental housing is not exempt property. And that it's, you know, we passed in 2023, 4D, we expanded that to rental property owned, to low, you know, affordable housing owned by nonprofit landlords, owned and operated by them. And so they get a preferential classification rate, like a really very preferential, classification rate. And so what this bill says is that property, that low-income rental housing that is operated by an exempt entity, they're still liable for the property taxes for it. And part of the reason I wanted Norris to be Vice Chair Norris to be the chair is because like I'm obviously not a lawyer, I'm semi struggling to explain this to you, but Mr. Chair, would you maybe see if Nonpartisan has anything to add or wants to tell me what I said wrong in the...
Sure. We'll go to Mr. Cope for additional analysis.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know that I have anything to add, but happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of testifiers, I think, next.
Absolutely. First up, we have Deputy Assessor Ben Thomas. Welcome to the committee. Deputy Assessor Thomas, please state your name and organization for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, and members of the committee. My name is Ben Thomas, and I'm the Deputy County Assessor for St. Louis County. Normally when I'm addressing a crowd in a room like this, it's a local board review. This is a much friendlier setting. This is nice. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of St. Louis County. We support the language proposed in this bill, which would clarify state law and policy regarding the taxation of residential properties owned and leased by institutions of purely public charity following the Alliance Housing v. Hennepin County decision. In St. Louis County, this decision has already resulted in the exemption of a $5.2 million apartment building in the city of Duluth, with an additional $3.6 million property presently under petition in tax court. For us, the potential for further exemption of property could extend to over $200 million of 4D low-income housing classified property. All of this tax burden would be shifted to other county taxpayers. You're going to hear from the Hennepin County Assessor here today, too, about some of the logistical challenges in administering the taxation of the leases in these now exempt buildings. State law requires the taxation of these leases, and this was the subject of the Department of Revenue memo to assessors that Chair Gomez just referenced. For us, it was not possible to set up individual personal property accounts for tenants in these exempted properties, as the exempted property owner was not required by law to provide leases or other information to the county assessor. When we requested this information, they refused to provide it. Prior to the Alliance decision, residential properties that also provided services to the occupants of the property were eligible to qualify for property tax exemption. The proposed language of House File 2274 would codify this requirement and would best support property tax base administration and stability statewide going forward. I join with my other assessor colleagues and others here who are here to urge you to act favorably on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Assessor Thomas. Next up, we have Josh Hoagland. Welcome to the committee, Assessor Hoagland. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, Chair Norris. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Josh Hoagland. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. But I'm actually here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers in my capacity as legislative chair. And I would be remiss if I did not take the opportunity to share with Chair Davids that I'm a proud Delano Tiger.
Oh.
First of all, I just want to voice support for this proposal. A lot of what I'm going to say has already been mentioned, and I'd like to reiterate some of those facts. This proposal avoids assessors placing valuations and taxes on low-income individuals and families in rental housing. As was mentioned, the Supreme Court decision held that charitable organizations that own rental property can be exempt from property tax. There's three considerations that primarily affect assessors. Some of what was already mentioned, there was legislation in 2023 that aided low-income housing in their classification rate. I'd like to highlight that in Hennepin County, countywide, tax collection in 2024 on 4D low-income housing was approximately $30.4 million. For 2025, it's going to be closer to $14.7 million, just as a result of that legislative change to the class rate. Also been mentioned, but I want to highlight that tenants will now be responsible for those taxes. And that's primarily based on two sections of statute. When a property is exempt, assessors are required to look typically first at 272.01, that requires uses by organizations or individuals for profit to be taxed on a personal property account. Personal property means that it's a personal lien or a personal liability to that individual or entity. If it's not a use for profit, then we look at 273.19, which requires us to basically put a valuation and tax on any other uses that might not qualify for exemption, as is this case. Other examples of where we would issue a personal property account are Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, the tenants within that, because MAC is an exempt entity, are taxed based on personal property. Cellular antennas on the top of a city-owned water tower are another big example for assessors. Individually owned airport hangars at MAC-owned property is another example where 273.19 would be in play. I also want to talk a little bit about the cycle on personal property. So the court case occurred in March of 2024, so it's really effective for the first time on the January 2nd, 2025 assessment, which means taxes are going to be due on those personal property accounts in 2026. Oftentimes, people move around. It's not a lien on the land any longer, it's a lien on the person. So somebody may have vacated their apartment unit by the time we get to that tax notice in March of 26. They're still obligated to pay it. I also want to highlight that those tenants, because they're not operators qualifying for the 4D rate, are going to be taxed at the higher rates of 4A, 1.25%, and 4B non-homestead, residential non-homestead at 1% versus the 0.25. I also want to highlight that this law impacts every county in the state. Every county in the state has 4D property within it, and any one of them has an opportunity to now qualify for exemption, which is why we're here on a statewide basis. Again, MAAO supports prevention of taxing those low-income tenants. I also want to thank Chair Gomez for bringing this forward as a solution to that problem. And I'm prepared for any questions.
Great. Thank you, Assessor Hoagland. Any other members of the public who wish to testify? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion, and kicking us off is going to be Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Norris. I want to thank Chair Gomez for taking care of this. This is a court decision. She's reacted quickly and I think accurately. But members, my big thing here is please don't look at the revenue note and the cost. We're not counting costs and tax code. just so you're aware of that. So, Chair Gomez, thank you. And if you'd allow me, I'd like to become an other on this bill. I think it's a very good bill and needs to be done, and I think it takes care of the problem. Thank you, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Any other member discussion? No. Representative Elkins.
Yeah. This is a very important bill. I mean, one of the things that I've observed in the work I do related to housing is that you know, just even because of the 4D, there are cities that avoid zoning for affordable housing because of the revenue impacts, the tax shifts. So this is really, really important.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Yeah, just quick. I don't quite understand the solution, but I can get that there's a problem. I mean, that's insane to be billing people. So I'm glad that you found a solution. So thank you.
Great. All right. Well, with that, any closing comments, Chair Gomez?
That I appreciate especially the assessors from Hennepin and St. Louis for being here and just for putting a lot of thought into this. I think we share the goal, obviously, of not sending random tax bills to low-income tenants that they're not expecting. That has to have been a kind of disconcerting letter to have received from Mr. Hoagland in the mail for those folks who received that. But, we can come up with a solution before those bills are due, and I'm, hopeful that we'll do so. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Chair Gomez. And with that, Chair Gomez renews her motion that House File 2257 be laid over in the 2025 taxes bill. And the bill is laid over. Yeah. All right, so members, our next meeting is tomorrow, March 27th. Chair Davids, any preview of tomorrow's hearing?
Okay, thank you, Chair Norris, for tomorrow. It's a Cretia bill, House File 1833, McDonald, House File 148, Robbins, 1127, Witte, 1227, David, 1681. Then go to Franzen, 1974, Agaje, 1106, and then we'll come back and finish up in very, very short order, less than 5 minutes, the Robbins Working Family Credit Bill. Thank you, Chair Norris. Maybe 5 minutes or so. Yeah.
We'll find out tomorrow. Thank you, Chair Davids. All right, and with that, members, we are adjourned.